This is Audible.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents The Guns of August by Barbara W. Tuchman. The book is prefaced by two quotations. "The human heart is the starting point of all matters pertaining to war," Maréchal de Saxe's Reveries on the Art of War. "The terrible ifs accumulate," Winston Churchill, The World Crisis. Preface. The genesis of this book lies in two earlier books I wrote, of which the First World War was the focal point of both. The first was Bible and Sword, about the origins of the Balfour Declaration, issued in 1917, in anticipation of the British entry into Jerusalem in the course of the war against Turkey in the Middle East. As the centre and source of the Judeo-Christian religion, and incidentally of the Muslim as well, although that was a matter of lesser concern at the time, the taking of the sacred city was felt to be an awesome moment, requiring some major gesture to accompany it and provide a fitting moral foundation. An official statement recognizing Palestine as the national homeland of the original inhabitants was conceived to fulfill the need, not in consequence of any philo-Semitism, but in consequence rather of two other factors: the influence in British culture of the Bible, especially the Old Testament, and a twin influence in that year of what the Manchester Guardian called the insistent logic of the military situation on the banks of the Suez Canal. In short, Bible and Sword. The second of the two books preceding The Guns was The Zimmermann Telegram, a proposal by the then German Foreign Minister, Arthur Zimmermann, to induce Mexico, together with Japan, to make war as an ally of Germany on the United States, with the promise of regaining her lost territories of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. Zimmermann's clever idea was to keep the United States busy on her own continent, so as to prevent her entering the war in Europe. However, it accomplished the reverse, when, in the form of a wireless telegram to the President of Mexico, it was decoded by the British and made available to and published by the American government. Zimmermann's proposal aroused the anger of the public and helped to precipitate the United States into the war. I had always thought, in my acquaintance with history up to that point, that 1914 was the hour when the clock struck, so to speak, the date that ended the 19th century and began our own age, the terrible 20th, as Churchill called it. In seeking the subject for a book, I felt that 1914 was it. But I did not know what should be the gateway or the framework. Just at the moment when I was floundering in search of the right approach, a small miracle dropped in my lap when my agent called to ask, "Would you like to talk to a publisher who wants you to do a book on 1914? I was struck, as the phrase goes, all of a heap, but not to the extent that I couldn't say, "Well, yes, I would," even if rather perturbed that someone else had my idea, although happy he had it with regard to the right person. He was a Britisher, Cecil Scott of the Macmillan Company, now regretfully deceased, and what he wanted, as he told me later when we met, was a book about what really happened at the Battle of Mons, the first encounter overseas of the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, in 1914, which had been such an extraordinary survival and check to the Germans that legends grew of supernatural intervention. I was going skiing that week after the meeting with Mr. Scott and took along a suitcase of books to Vermont. I came home with a proposal to do a book on the escape of the Goeben, the German battleship which, by eluding a pursuit by British cruisers in the Mediterranean, had reached Constantinople and brought Turkey, and with it the whole Ottoman Empire of the Middle East, into the war, determining the course of the history of that area from that day to this. The Goeben seemed a natural for me, for it had become family history, which we had witnessed, including myself, at the age of two. That happened when we two were crossing the Mediterranean en route to Constantinople to visit my grandfather, who was then American ambassador to the port. It was an often told story in the family circle how the puffs of gun smoke from the pursuing British cruisers were seen from our ship, and how the Goeben put on speed and got away, and how, on arriving at Constantinople, we were the first to bring news to officials and diplomats of the capital of the drama at sea that we had seen. My mother's account of her heavy questioning by the German ambassador before she could even debark or had a chance to greet her father was my first impression, almost at first hand, of the German manner. Almost 30 years later, when I returned from my skiing week in Vermont and told Mr. Scott that this was the story of 1914 that I wanted to write, he said, no, that was not what he wanted. He was still fixed on Mons. How had the BEF thrown back the Germans? Had they really seen the vision of an angel over the battlefield? And what was the basis of the legend of the Angel of Mons, afterwards so important on the Western Front? Frankly, I was still more interested in the Goeben than in the Angel of Mons, but the fact of a publisher ready for a book on 1914 was more important than either. The war as a whole seemed too large and beyond my capacity, but Mr. Scott kept telling me I could do it, and when I formed the plan of keeping to the war's first month, which contained all the routes, including the Goeben and the Battle of Mons, to make us both happy, the project began to seem feasible. When mired among all those Roman-numeraled corps and left and right flanks, I soon felt out of my depth and felt I should have gone to staff and command school for 10 years before undertaking a book of this kind, especially when trying to tell how the French on the defensive managed to regain Alsace at the very beginning, which I never did understand, but I managed to weave my way in and around it, a manoeuvre one learns in the process of writing history, to muffle the facts a bit when one can't understand everything. Watch Gibbon do it in those sonorous, balanced sentences, which if you analyse them often turn out to make little sense, but you forget that in the marvel of their structure. I am no Gibbon, but I have learned the value of venturing into the unfamiliar, instead of returning to a field of previous study, where one already knows the source material and all the persons and circumstances. To do the latter makes the work certainly easier, but removes any sense of discovery and surprise, which is why I like moving to a new subject for a new book. Though it may distress the critics, it pleases me. Since I was hardly known to the critics when The Guns was published, with no reputation for them to enjoy smashing, the book received instead the warmest reception. Clifton Fadiman wrote in the Book of the Month Club Bulletin, "One must be careful with the big words. Still, there is a fair chance that The Guns of August may turn out to be a historical classic. Its virtues are almost Thucydian. Intelligence, concision, weight, detachment." Dealing with the days preceding and following the outbreak of the First World War, its subject, like that of Thucydides, goes beyond the limited scope and reach of the mere narrative. For in hard, sculptured prose, this book fixes the moments that have led inexorably to our own time. It places our dread day in long perspective, arguing that if most of the world's men, women and children are soon to be burned to atoms, the annihilation would seem to proceed directly out of the mouths of the guns that spoke in August 1914. This may be an oversimplification, but it describes the author's thesis, which she presents with deadly quiet. It is her conviction that the deadlock of the terrible month of August determined the future course of the war and the terms of the peace, the shape of the interwar period, and the conditions of the second round. He then went on to describe the main actors in the narrative, saying that one of the marks of the superior historian is the ability to project human beings as well as events. And he picked out the salient characters, the Kaiser, King Albert, Generals Joffre and Foch, among others, just as I had tried to convey them, which made me feel I'd succeeded in what I intended. I was so moved by Fadiman's understanding, not to mention being compared to Thucydides, that I found myself in tears, a reaction that I have never known again. To elicit perfect comprehension is perhaps to be expected only once. I suppose the important thing to say in introducing an anniversary edition is whether the significance given to it historically holds up. I think it does. There are no passages I would wish to change. While the best-known part is the opening scene on the funeral of Edward VII, the closing paragraph of the afterword expresses for the book, or rather for its subject, the meaning in our history of the Great War. Though it may be presumptuous of me to say so, I think this is as well stated as any summary of World War I that I know. On top of Faderman's praise came a startling prediction by Publishers Weekly, the Bible of the book trade. The Guns of August, it declared, will be the biggest new non-fiction seller in your winter season. Carried away by its own superlative, P.W. was led to some rather eccentric prose, stating that the book will grip the American reading public with a new enthusiasm for the electric moments of this hitherto neglected chapter of history. I did not think that enthusiasm for the Great War was quite the noun I would have chosen, or that one could feel enthusiasm for electric moments, or that one could justly call World War I, which had the longest list of titles in the New York Public Library, a neglected chapter in history. Nevertheless, I was pleased by P.W.'s hearty welcome. Given the fact that in moments of depression during the course of writing, I had said to Mr. Scott, "Who is going to read this?" And he had replied, "Two people, you will and I will." That was hardly encouraging, which made P.W.'s pronouncement all the more astonishing to me. As it turned out, they were right. The Guns took off like a runaway horse, and my children, to whom I assigned the royalties and foreign rights, have been receiving nice little checks ever since. When divided among three, the amount may be small, but it is good to know that after 26 years the book is still making its way to new readers. With this new edition, I am happy that the book is being introduced to a new generation, and I hope that in middle age it will not have lost its charm, or, to put it more appropriately, its interest. Barbara W. Tuckman. Chapter 1. A Funeral. So gorgeous was the spectacle on the May morning of 1910, when 9 kings rode in the funeral of Edward VII of England, that the crowd, waiting in hushed and black-clad awe, could not keep back gasps of admiration. In scarlet and blue and green and purple, 3 by 3, the sovereigns rode through the palace gates, with plumed helmets, gold braid, crimson sashes, and jewelled orders flashing in the sun. After them came 5 heirs apparent, 40 more imperial or royal highnesses, 7 queens, 4 dowager and 3 regnant, and a scattering of special ambassadors from uncrowned countries. Together they represented 70 nations, in the greatest assemblage of royalty and rank ever gathered in one place, and, of its kind, the last. The muffled tongue of Big Ben tolled 9 by the clock as the cortege left the palace. But on history's clock it was sunset, and the sun of the old world was setting in a dying blaze of splendour, never to be seen again. In the centre of the front row rode the new king, George V, flanked on his left by the Duke of Connaught, the late king's only surviving brother, and on his right by a personage to whom, acknowledged the Times, belongs the first place among all the foreign mourners, who, even when relations are most strained, has never lost his popularity amongst us, William II, the German Emperor. Mounted on a grey horse, wearing the scarlet uniform of a British field marshal, carrying the baton of that rank, the Kaiser had composed his features behind the famous upturned moustache in an expression grave even to severity. Of the several emotions churning his susceptible breast, some hints exist in his letters. "I am proud to call this place my home and to be a member of this royal family," he wrote home, after spending the night in Windsor Castle, in the former apartments of his mother. Sentiment and nostalgia induced by these melancholy occasions with his English relatives jostled with pride in his supremacy among the assembled potentates, and with a fierce relish in the disappearance of his uncle from the European scene. He had come to bury Edward his bane, Edward the arch-plotter, as William conceived it, of Germany's encirclement. Edward, his mother's brother, whom he could neither bully nor impress, whose fat figure cast a shadow between Germany and the sun. "He is Satan. You cannot imagine what a Satan he is." This verdict, announced by the Kaiser before a dinner of 300 guests in Berlin in 1907, was occasioned by one of Edward's continental tours, undertaken with clearly diabolical designs at encirclement. He had spent a provocative week in Paris, visited for no good reason the King of Spain, who had just married his niece, and finished with a visit to the King of Italy, with obvious intent to seduce him from his triple alliance with Germany and Austria. The Kaiser, possessor of the least inhibited tongue in Europe, had worked himself into a frenzy, ending in another of those comments that had periodically over the past 20 years of his reign shattered the nerves of diplomats. Happily, the encircler was now dead and replaced by George, who, the Kaiser told Theodore Roosevelt a few days before the funeral, was a very nice boy of 45, 6 years younger than the Kaiser. He is a thorough Englishman and hates all foreigners, but I do not mind that as long as he does not hate Germans more than other foreigners. Alongside George, William now rode confidently, saluting as he passed the regimental colours of the 1st Royal Dragoons, of which he was honorary colonel. Once he had distributed photographs of himself wearing their uniform, with the Delphic inscription written above his signature, "I bide my time." Today his time had come. He was supreme in Europe. Behind him rode the widowed Queen Alexandra's two brothers, King Frederick of Denmark and King George of the Hellenes, her nephew, King Haakon of Norway, and three kings who were to lose their thrones, Alfonso of Spain, Manuel of Portugal, and wearing a silk turban, King Ferdinand of Bulgaria, who annoyed his fellow sovereigns by calling himself Tsar, and kept in a chest a Byzantine emperor's full regalia, acquired from a theatrical costumer, against the day when he should reassemble the Byzantine dominions beneath his scepter. Dazzled by these splendidly mounted princes, as the Times called them, few observers had eyes for the ninth king, the only one among them who was to achieve greatness as a man. Despite his great height and perfect horsemanship, Albert, King of the Belgians, who disliked the pomp of royal ceremony, contrived in that company to look both embarrassed and absent-minded. He was then 35 and had been on the throne barely a year. In later years, when his face became known to the world as a symbol of heroism and tragedy, it still always wore that abstracted look, as if his mind were on something else. The future source of tragedy, tall, corpulent and corseted, with green plumes waving from his helmet, Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria, heir of the old Emperor Franz Josef, rode on Albert's right, and on his left another scion who would never reach his throne, Prince Yusuf, heir of the Sultan of Turkey. After the kings came the Royal Highnesses, Prince Fushimi, brother of the Emperor of Japan, Grand Duke Michael, brother of the Tsar of Russia, the Duke of Aosta, in bright blue with green plumes, brother of the King of Italy, Prince Karl, brother of the King of Sweden, Prince Henry, consort of the Queen of Holland, and the Crown Princes of Serbia, Romania, and Montenegro. The last named, Prince Danilo, an amiable, extremely handsome young man of delightful manners, resembled the merry widow's lover in more than name, for to the consternation of British functionaries, he had arrived the night before accompanied by a charming young lady of great personal attractions, whom he introduced as his wife's lady-in-waiting, with the explanation that she had come to London to do some shopping. A regiment of minor German royalty followed, rulers of Mecklenburg-Schwerin, Mecklenburg-Strelitz, Waldeck-Pyrmont, Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, of Saxony, Hesse, Württemberg, Baden, and Bavaria, of whom the last, Crown Prince Ruprecht, was soon to lead a German army in battle. There were a Prince of Siam, a Prince of Persia, five princes of the former French royal house of Orléans, a brother of the Khedive of Egypt, wearing a gold-tasseled fez, Prince Zai Tao of China, in an embroidered light blue gown, whose ancient dynasty had 2 more years to run, and the Kaiser's brother, Prince Henry of Prussia, representing the German navy, of which he was commander-in-chief. Amid all this magnificence were 3 civilian-coated gentlemen, Monsieur Gaston Carlin of Switzerland, Monsieur Pichon, Foreign Minister of France, and former President Theodore Roosevelt, Special Envoy of the United States. Edward, the object of this unprecedented gathering of nations, was often called the Uncle of Europe, a title which, insofar as Europe's ruling houses were meant, could be taken literally. He was the uncle not only of Kaiser Wilhelm, but also, through his wife's sister, the Dowager Empress Marie of Russia, of Tsar Nicholas II. His own niece, Alex, was the Tsarina, his daughter Maud was Queen of Norway, another niece, Ina, was Queen of Spain, A third niece, Marie, was soon to be Queen of Romania. The Danish family of his wife, besides occupying the throne of Denmark, had mothered the Tsar of Russia and supplied kings to Greece and Norway. Other relatives, the progeny at various removes of Queen Victoria's 9 sons and daughters, were scattered in abundance throughout the courts of Europe. Yet not family feeling alone, nor even the suddenness and shock of Edward's death, for to public knowledge he'd been ill one day and dead the next, accounted for the unexpected flood of condolences at his passing. It was in fact a tribute to Edward's great gift as a sociable king, which had proved invaluable to his country. In the 9 short years of his reign, England's splendid isolation had given way, under pressure, to a series of understandings or attachments, but not quite alliances, for England dislikes the definitive, with 2 old enemies, France and Russia, and 1 promising new power, Japan. The resulting shift in balance registered itself around the world and affected every state's relations with every other. Though Edward neither initiated nor influenced his country's policy, his personal diplomacy helped to make the change possible. Taken as a child to visit France, he'd said to Napoleon III, "You have a nice country. I would like to be your son." This preference for things French, in contrast to, or perhaps in protest against his mother's for the Germanic, lasted, and after her death was put to use. When England, growing edgy over the challenge implicit in Germany's naval program of 1900, decided to patch up old quarrels with France, Edward's talents as roi charmeur smoothed the way. In 1903 he went to Paris, disregarding advice that an official state visit would find a cold welcome. On his arrival, the crowds were sullen and silent, except for a few taunting cries of "Vive les Boers!" and "Vive Fashoda!" which the king ignored. To a worried aide who muttered, "The French don't like us," he replied, "Why should they?" and continued bowing and smiling from his carriage. For 4 days he made appearances, reviewed troops at Vincennes, attended the races at Longchamp, a gala at the Opera, a state banquet at the Élysée, a luncheon at the Quai d'Orsay, and at the theatre transformed a chill into smiles by mingling with the audience in the entr'acte and paying gallant compliments in French to a famous actress in the lobby. Everywhere he made gracious and tactful speeches about his friendship and admiration for the French, their glorious traditions, their beautiful city, for which he confessed an attachment fortified by many happy memories, his sincere pleasure in the visit, his belief that old misunderstandings are happily over and forgotten, that the mutual prosperity of France and England was interdependent, and their friendship his constant preoccupation. When he left, the crowds now shouted, "Vive notre roi!" Seldom has such a complete change of attitude been seen as that which has taken place in this country. He has won the hearts of all the French, a Belgian diplomat reported. The German ambassador thought the king's visit was a most odd affair, and supposed that an Anglo-French rapprochement was the result of a general aversion to Germany. Within a year, after hard work by ministers settling disputes, the rapprochement became the Anglo-French Entente, signed in April 1904. Germany might have had an English Entente for herself, had not her leaders, suspecting English motives, rebuffed the overtures of the colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, in 1899 and again in 1901. Neither the shadowy Holstein, who conducted Germany's foreign affairs from behind the scenes, nor the elegant and erudite Chancellor Prince Bülow, nor the Kaiser himself was quite sure what they suspected England of, but they were certain it was something perfidious. The Kaiser always wanted an agreement with England, if he could get one without seeming to want it. Once, affected by English surroundings and family sentiment at the funeral of Queen Victoria, he allowed himself to confess the wish to Edward. "Not a mouse could stir in Europe without our permission," was the way he visualized an Anglo-German alliance. But as soon as the English showed signs of willingness, he and his ministers veered off, suspecting some trick. Fearing to be taken advantage of at the conference table, they preferred to stay away altogether and depend upon an ever-growing navy to frighten the English into coming to terms. Bismarck had warned Germany to be content with land power, but his successors were neither separately nor collectively Bismarck's. He had pursued clearly seen goals unswervingly. They groped for larger horizons with no clear idea of what they wanted. Holstein was a Machiavelli without a policy who operated on only one principle, suspect everyone. Bülow had no principles. He was so slippery, lamented his colleague, Admiral Tirpitz, that compared to him, an eel was a leech. The flashing, inconstant, always freshly inspired Kaiser had a different goal every hour and practiced diplomacy as an exercise in perpetual motion. None of them believed England would ever come to terms with France, and all warnings of that event Holstein dismissed as naive, even a most explicit one from his envoy in London, Baron Eckhardstein. At a dinner at Marlborough House in 1902, Eckhardstein had watched Paul Cambon, the French ambassador, disappear into the billiard room with Joseph Chamberlain, where they engaged in animated conversation lasting 28 minutes, of which the only words he could overhear, the Baron's memoirs do not say whether the door was open or he was listening at the keyhole, were Egypt and Morocco. Later, he was summoned to the King's study, where Edward offered him an 1888 Upman cigar and told him that England was going to reach a settlement with France over all disputed colonial questions. When the Entente became a fact, William's wrath was tremendous. Beneath it, and even more galling, rankled Edward's triumph in Paris. The Reisekaiser, as he was known from the frequency of his travels, derived balm from ceremonial entries into foreign capitals, and the one above all he wished to visit was Paris, the unattainable. He had been everywhere, even to Jerusalem, where the Jaffa Gate had to be cut to permit his entry on horseback. But Paris, the centre of all that was beautiful, all that was desirable, all that Berlin was not, remained closed to him. He wanted to receive the acclaim of Parisians and be awarded the Grand Cordon of the Legion of Honour, and twice let the imperial wish be known to the French. No invitation ever came. He could enter Alsace and make speeches glorifying the victory of 1870. He could lead parades through Metz in Lorraine. But it is perhaps the saddest story of the fate of kings that the Kaiser lived to be 82 and died without seeing Paris. Envy of the older nations gnawed at him. He complained to Theodore Roosevelt that the English nobility on continental tours never visited Berlin, but always went to Paris. He felt unappreciated. "All the long years of my reign," he told the King of Italy, "my colleagues, the monarchs of Europe, have paid no attention to what I have to say. Soon, with my great navy to endorse my words, they will be more respectful." The same sentiments ran through his whole nation, which suffered, like their emperor, from a terrible need for recognition. Pulsing with energy and ambition, conscious of strength, fed upon Nietzsche and Treitschke, they felt entitled to rule, and cheated that the world did not acknowledge their title. "We must," wrote Friedrich von Bernhardi, the spokesman of militarism, "secure to German nationality and German spirit throughout the globe that high esteem which is due them and has hitherto been withheld from them." He frankly allowed only one method of attaining the goal. Lesser Bernhardis, from the Kaiser down, sought to secure the esteem they craved by threats and show of power. They shook the mailed fist, demanded their place in the sun, and proclaimed the virtues of the sword in paeans to blood and iron and shining armour. In German practice, Mr. Roosevelt's current precept for getting on with your neighbours was Teutonized to "speak loudly and brandish a big gun." When they brandished it, when the Kaiser told his troops departing for China and the Boxer Rebellion to bear themselves as the Huns of Attila, the choice of Huns as German prototypes was his own, when pan-German societies and navy leagues multiplied and met in congresses to demand that other nations recognize their legitimate aims toward expansion, the other nations answered with alliances, and when they did, Germany screamed "Einkreisung," encirclement. The refrain "Deutschland ganzlich einzukreisen" grated over the decade. Edward's foreign visits continued: Rome, Vienna, Lisbon, Madrid, and not to royalty only. Every year he took the curate Marienbad, where he would exchange views with the Tiger of France, born in the same year as himself, who was premier for 4 of the years that Edward was king. Edward, whose 2 passions in life were correct clothes and unorthodox company, overlooked the former and admired Monsieur Clemenceau. The Tiger shared Napoleon's opinion that Prussia was hatched from a cannonball and saw the cannonball coming in his direction. He worked, he planned, he manoeuvred in the shadow of one dominant idea. The German lust for power has fixed as its policy the extermination of France. He told Edward that when the time came when France needed help, England's sea power would not be enough, and reminded him that Napoleon was beaten at Waterloo, not Trafalgar. In 1908, to the distaste of his subjects, Edward paid a state visit to the Tsar aboard the imperial yacht at Reval. English imperialists regarded Russia as the ancient foe of the Crimea, and more recently as the menace looming over India, while to the liberals and labourites, Russia was the land of the knout, the pogrom, and the massacred revolutionaries of 1905, and the Tsar, according to Mr. Ramsay MacDonald, a common murderer. The distaste was reciprocated. Russia detested England's alliance with Japan and resented her as the power that frustrated Russia's historic yearning for Constantinople and the Straits. Nicholas II once combined 2 favourite prejudices in the simple statement, "An Englishman is a jid, a Jew." But old antagonisms were not so strong as new pressures, and under the urging of the French, who were anxious to have their 2 allies come to terms, an Anglo-Russian convention was signed in 1907. A personal touch of royal friendliness was felt to be required to clear away any lingering mistrust, and Edward embarked for Reval. He had long talks with the Russian foreign minister, Izvolsky, and danced the Merry Widow Waltz with the Tsarina with such effect as to make her laugh, the first man to accomplish this feat since the unhappy woman put on the crown of the Romanovs. Nor was it such a frivolous achievement as might appear, for though it could hardly be said that the Tsar governed Russia in a working sense, he ruled as an autocrat and was in turn ruled by his strong-willed, if weak-witted, wife. Beautiful, hysterical, and morbidly suspicious, she hated everyone but her immediate family and a series of fanatic or lunatic charlatans who offered comfort to her desperate soul. The Tsar, neither well-endowed mentally nor very well-educated, was, in the Kaiser's opinion, only fit to live in a country house and grow turnips. The Kaiser regarded the Tsar as his own sphere of influence, and tried by clever schemes to woo him out of his French alliance, which had been the consequence of William's own folly. Bismarck's maxim, "Keep friends with Russia," and the reinsurance treaty that implemented it, William had dropped along with Bismarck in the first and worst blunder of his reign. Alexander III, the tall, stern Tsar of that day, had promptly turned around in 1892 and entered into alliance with Republican France, even at the cost of standing at attention to the Marseillaise. Besides, he snubbed William, whom he considered un garçon mal élevé, and would only talk to him over his shoulder. Ever since Nicholas acceded to the throne, William had been trying to repair his blunder by writing the young Tsar long letters in English of advice, gossip, and political harangue addressed to Dearest Nicky and signed Your Affectionate Friend, Willie. An irreligious republic stained by the blood of monarchs was no fit company for him, he told the Tsar. Nicky, take my word for it, the curse of God has stricken that people forever. Nicky's true interests, Willie told him, were with a Dreikaiserbund, a league of the 3 emperors of Russia, Austria, and Germany. Yet remembering the old Tsar's snubs, he could not help patronizing his son. He would tap Nicholas on the shoulder and say, "My advice to you is more speeches and more parades, more speeches, more parades." And he offered to send German troops to protect Nicholas from his rebellious subjects, a suggestion which infuriated the Tsarina, who hated William more after every exchange of visits. When he failed, under the circumstances, to wean Russia away from France, the Kaiser drew up an ingenious treaty engaging Russia and Germany to aid each other in case of attack, which the Tsar, after signing, was to communicate to the French and invite them to join. After Russia's disasters in her war with Japan, which the Kaiser had strenuously urged her into, and the revolutionary risings that followed, when the regime was at its lowest ebb, he invited the Tsar to a secret rendezvous without attendant ministers at Bürkö in the Gulf of Finland. William knew well enough that Russia could not accede to his treaty without breaking faith with the French, but he thought that sovereign signatures were all that was needed to erase the difficulty. Nicholas signed. William was in ecstasy. He had made good the fatal lapse, secured Germany's back door, and broken the encirclement. "Bright tears stood in my eyes," he wrote to Bülow, and he was sure Grandpa, William I, who had died muttering about a war on two fronts, was looking down on him. He felt his treaty to be the master coup of German diplomacy, as indeed it was, or would have been but for a flaw in the title. When the Tsar brought the treaty home, his ministers, after one horrified look, pointing out that by engaging to join Germany in a possible war, he had repudiated his alliance with France, a detail which no doubt escaped His Majesty in the flood of the Emperor William's eloquence. The Treaty of Bürkö lived its brief shimmering day and expired. Now came Edward hobnobbing with the Tsar at Reval. Reading the German ambassador's report of the meeting, which suggested that Edward really desired peace, the Kaiser scribbled furiously in the margin, "Lies, he wants war, but I have to start it so he does not have the odium." The year closed with the most explosive faux pas of the Kaiser's career, an interview given to the Daily Telegraph expressing his ideas of the day on who should fight whom, which this time unnerved not only his neighbours but his countrymen. Public disapproval was so outspoken that the Kaiser took to his bed, was ill for 3 weeks, and remained comparatively reticent for some time thereafter. Since then, no new excitements had erupted. The last 2 years of the decade, while Europe enjoyed a rich, fat afternoon, were the quietest. 1910 was peaceful and prosperous, with the second round of Moroccan crises and Balkan wars still to come. A new book, The Great Illusion, by Norman Angell, had just been published, which proved that war had become vain. By impressive examples and incontrovertible argument, Angell showed that in the present financial and economic interdependence of nations, the victor would suffer equally with the vanquished. Therefore, war had become unprofitable. Therefore, no nation would be so foolish as to start one. Already translated into 11 languages, The Great Illusion had become a cult. At the universities, in Manchester, Glasgow, and other industrial cities, more than 40 study groups of true believers had formed, devoted to propagating its dogma. Angell's most earnest disciple was a man of great influence on military policy, the King's friend and adviser, Viscount Escher, chairman of the War Committee, assigned to remaking the British Army after the shock of its performance in the Boer War. Lord Escher delivered lectures on the lesson of the Great Illusion at Cambridge and the Sorbonne, wherein he showed how new economic factors clearly prove the inanity of aggressive wars. A 20th century war would be on such a scale, he said, that its inevitable consequences of commercial disaster, financial ruin, and individual suffering would be so pregnant with restraining influences as to make war unthinkable. He told an audience of officers at the United Service Club, with the Chief of General Staff Sir John French in the chair, that because of the interlacing of nations, war becomes every day more difficult and improbable. Germany, Lord Escher felt sure, is as receptive as Great Britain to the doctrine of Norman Angell. How receptive were the Kaiser and the Crown Prince, to whom he gave or caused to be given copies of The Great Illusion, is not reported. There is no evidence that he gave one to General von Bernhardi, who was engaged in 1910 in writing a book called Germany and the Next War, published in the following year, which was to be as influential as Angell's, but from the opposite point of view. Three of its chapter titles, The Right to Make War, The Duty to Make War, and World Power or Downfall, sum up its thesis. As a 21-year-old cavalry officer in 1870, Bernhardi had been the first German to ride through the Arc de Triomphe when the Germans entered Paris. Since then, flags and glory interested him less than the theory, philosophy, and science of war, as applied to Germany's Historic Mission, another of his chapter titles. He had served as chief of the military history section of the general staff, was one of the intellectual elite of that hard-thinking, hard-working body, and author of a classic on cavalry, before he assembled a lifetime's studies of Clausewitz, Treitschke, and Darwin, and poured them into the book that was to make his name a synonym for Mars. War, he stated, is a biological necessity. It is the carrying out among humankind of the natural law upon which all the laws of nature rest, the law of the struggle for existence. Nations, he said, must progress or decay. There can be no standing still, and Germany must choose world power or downfall. Among the nations, Germany is in social political respects at the head of all progress in culture, but is compressed into narrow unnatural limits. She cannot attain her great moral ends without increased political power, an enlarged sphere of influence, and new territory. This increase in power, befitting our importance and which we are entitled to claim, is a political necessity and the first and foremost duty of the state. In his own italics, Bernhardi announced, "What we now wish to attain must be fought for." And from here he galloped home to the finish line. Conquest thus becomes a law of necessity. Having proved the necessity, the favourite word of German military thinkers, Bernhardi proceeded to method. Once the duty to make war is recognised, the secondary duty to make it successfully follows. To be successful, a state must begin war at the most favourable moment of its own choosing. It has the acknowledged right to secure the proud privilege of such initiative. Offensive war thus becomes another necessity and a second conclusion inescapable. It is incumbent on us to act on the offensive and strike the first blow. Bernhardi did not share the Kaiser's concern about the odium that attached to an aggressor, nor was he reluctant to tell where the blow would fall. It was unthinkable, he wrote, that Germany and France could ever negotiate their problems. France must be so completely crushed that she can never cross our path again. She must be annihilated once and for all as a great power. King Edward did not live to read Bernhardi. In January 1910, he sent the Kaiser his annual birthday greetings and the gift of a walking stick before departing for Marienbaden-Biarritz. A few months later, he was dead. "We have lost the mainstay of our foreign policy," said Isfolsky when he heard the news. This was hyperbole, for Edward was merely the instrument, not the architect, of the new alignments. In France, the king's death created profound emotion and real consternation, according to Le Figaro. Paris, it said, felt the loss of its great friend as deeply as London. Lampposts and shop windows in the Rue de la Paix wore the same black as Piccadilly. Cab drivers tied crepe bows on their whips. Black-draped portraits of the late king appeared even in the provincial towns, as at the death of a great French citizen. In Tokyo, in tribute to the Anglo-Japanese alliance, houses bore the crossed flags of England and Japan with the staves draped in black. In Germany, whatever the feelings, correct procedures were observed. All officers of the army and navy were ordered to wear mourning for 8 days, and the fleet in home waters fired a salute and flew its flags at half-mast. The Reichstag rose to its feet to hear a message of sympathy read by its president, and the Kaiser called in person upon the British ambassador in a visit that lasted an hour and a half. In London the following week, the royal family was kept busy meeting royal arrivals at Victoria Station. The Kaiser came over on his yacht, the Hohenzollern, escorted by 4 British destroyers. He anchored in the Thames estuary and came the rest of the way to London by train, arriving at Victoria Station like the common royalty. A purple carpet was rolled out on the platform and purple-covered steps placed where his carriage would stop. As his train drew in on the stroke of noon, the familiar figure of the German Emperor stepped down to be greeted by his cousin King George, whom he kissed on both cheeks. After lunch they went together to Westminster Hall, where the body of Edward lay in state. A thunderstorm the night before, and drenching rains all morning, had not deterred the quiet, patient line of Edward's subjects waiting to pass through the hall. On this day, Thursday, May 19, the line stretched back for 5 miles. It was the day the Earth was due to pass through the tail of Halley's Comet, whose appearance called forth reminders that it was traditionally the prophet of disaster, had it not heralded the Norman conquest, and inspired journals with literary editors to print the lines from Julius Caesar. When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes. Inside the vast hall, the bier lay in somber majesty, surmounted by crown, orb, and scepter, and guarded at its four corners by four officers, each from different regiments of the empire, who stood in the traditional attitude of mourning, with bowed heads and white-gloved hands crossed over sword hilts. The Kaiser eyed all the customs of an imperial lying in state with professional interest. He was deeply impressed, and years later could recall every detail of the scene in its marvellous medieval setting. He saw the sun's rays filtered through the narrow Gothic windows, lighting up the jewels of the crown. He watched the changing of the guards at the bier as the four new guards marched forward with swords at the carry-up and turned them point down as they reached their places, while the guards they relieved glided away in slow motion to disappear through some unseen exit in the shadows. Laying his wreath of purple and white flowers on the coffin, he knelt with King George in silent prayer, and on rising grasped his cousin's hand in a manly and sympathetic handshake. The gesture, widely reported, caused much favourable comment. Publicly, his performance was perfect. Privately, he could not resist the opportunity for fresh scheming. At a dinner given by the king that night at Buckingham Palace for the 70 royal mourners and special ambassadors, he buttonholed Monsieur Pichon of France and proposed to him that in the event Germany should find herself opposed to England in a conflict, France should side with Germany. In view of the occasion and the place, this latest imperial brainstorm caused the same fuss that had once moved Sir Edward Grey, England's harassed foreign secretary, to remark wistfully, "The other sovereigns are so much quieter." The Kaiser later denied he had ever said anything of the kind. He had merely discussed Morocco and some other political matters. Monsieur Pichon could only be got to say discreetly that the Kaiser's language had been amiable and pacific. Next morning, in the procession, where for once he could not talk, William's behaviour was exemplary. He kept his horse reined in, a head behind King George's, and to Conan Doyle, special correspondent for the occasion, looked so noble that England has lost something of her old kindliness if she does not take him back into her heart today. When the procession reached Westminster Hall, he was the first to dismount, and as Queen Alexandra's carriage drew up, he ran to the door with such alacrity that he reached it before the royal servants, only to find that the Queen was about to descend on the other side. William scampered nimbly around, still ahead of the servants, reached the door first, handed out the widow and kissed her with the affection of a bereaved nephew. Fortunately, King George came up at this moment to rescue his mother and escort her himself, for she loathed the Kaiser, both personally and for the sake of Schleswig-Holstein. Though he had been but 8 years old when Germany seized the duchies from Denmark, she'd never forgiven him or his country. When her son, on a visit to Berlin in 1890, was made honorary colonel of a Prussian regiment, she wrote to him, "And so my Georgie boy has become a real-life, filthy, blue-coated, pickle-hob German soldier. Well, I never thought to have lived to see that. But never mind. It was your misfortune and not your fault." A roll of muffled drums and the wail of bagpipes sounded as the coffin, wrapped in the royal standard, was borne from the hall by a score of blue jackets in straw hats. A sudden shiver of sabres glittered in the sun as the cavalry came to attention. At a signal of four sharp whistles, the sailors hoisted the coffin onto the gun carriage, draped in purple, red, and white. The cortege moved on between motionless lines of grenadiers, like red walls that hemmed in the packed black masses of perfectly silent people. London was never so crowded, never so still. Alongside and behind the gun carriage, drawn by the Royal Horse Artillery, walked His Late Majesty's 63 aides-de-camp, all colonels or naval captains, and all peers, among them 5 dukes, 4 marquises, and 13 earls. England's 3 field marshals, Lord Kitchener, Lord Roberts, and Sir Evelyn Wood, rode together. 6 admirals of the fleet followed, and after them, walking all alone, Edward's great friend Sir John Fisher, the stormy, eccentric former First Sea Lord, with his queer, un-English Mandarin's face. Detachments from all the famous regiments, the Coldstreams, the Gordon Highlanders, the Household Cavalry and Cavalry of the Line, the Horse Guards and Lancers and Royal Fusiliers, brilliant hussars and dragoons of the German, Russian, Austrian and other foreign cavalry units, of which Edward had been honorary officer, admirals of the German Navy, almost, it seemed to some disapproving observers, too great a military show in the funeral of a man called the Peacemaker. His horse, with empty saddle and boots reversed in the stirrups, led by two grooms, and trotting along behind his wire-haired terrier Caesar, added a pang of personal sentiment. On came the pomp of England. Pursuivants of arms in emblazoned medieval tabards, silver stick in waiting, white staves, equerries, archers of Scotland, judges in wigs and black robes, and the Lord Chief Justice in scarlet, bishops in ecclesiastical purple, yeomen of the guard in black velvet hats and frilled Elizabethan collars, an escort of trumpeters, and then the parade of kings, followed by a glass coach bearing the widowed queen and her sister, the Dowager Empress of Russia, and 12 other coaches of queens, ladies, and oriental potentates. Along Whitehall, the Mall, Piccadilly, and the Park to Paddington Station, where the body was to go by train to Windsor for burial, the long procession moved. The Royal Horse Guards Band played the Dead March from Saul. People felt a finality in the slow tread of the marchers and in the solemn music. Lord Esher wrote in his diary after the funeral, "There never was such a break-up. All the old boys which have marked the channel of our lives seem to have been swept away." Plans. Chapter 2. Let the last man on the right brush the channel with his sleeve. Count Alfred von Schlieffen, chief of the German general staff from 1891 to 1906, was, like all German officers, schooled in Clausewitz's precept. The heart of France lies between Brussels and Paris. It was a frustrating axiom because the path it pointed to was forbidden by Belgian neutrality, which Germany, along with the other four major European powers, had guaranteed in perpetuity. Believing that war was a certainty and that Germany must enter it under conditions that gave her the most promise of success, Schlieffen determined not to allow the Belgian difficulty to stand in Germany's way. Of the two classes of Prussian officer, the bull-necked and the wasp-waisted, he belonged to the second. Monocled and effete in appearance, cold and distant in manner, he concentrated with such single-mindedness on his profession that when an aide, at the end of an all-night staff ride in East Prussia, pointed out to him the beauty of the River Pregel sparkling in the rising sun, the general gave a brief, hard look and replied, "An unimportant obstacle." So, too, he decided, was Belgian neutrality. A neutral and independent Belgium was the creation of England, or rather of England's ablest foreign minister, Lord Palmerston. Belgium's coast was England's frontier. On the plains of Belgium, Wellington had defeated the greatest threat to England since the Armada. Thereafter, England was determined to make that patch of open, easily traversable territory a neutral zone, and under the post-Napoleon settlement of the Congress of Vienna, agreed, with the other powers, to attach it to the Kingdom of the Netherlands. Resenting union with a Protestant power, burning with the fever of the 19th-century nationalism, the Belgians revolted in 1830, setting off an international scramble. The Dutch fought to retain their province, the French, eager to reabsorb what they had once ruled, moved in. The autocratic states, Russia, Prussia, and Austria, bent on keeping Europe clamped under the vice of Vienna, were ready to shoot at the first sight of revolt anywhere. Lord Palmerston outmaneuvered them all. He knew that a subject province would be an eternal temptation to one neighbour or another, and that only an independent nation, resolved to maintain its own integrity, could survive as a safety zone. Through 9 years of nerve, of suppleness, of never swerving from his aim, of calling out the British fleet, when necessary, he played off all contenders and secured an international treaty, guaranteeing Belgium as an independent and perpetually neutral state. The treaty was signed in 1839 by England, France, Russia, Prussia, and Austria. Ever since 1892, when France and Russia had joined in military alliance, it was clear that four of the five signatories of the Belgian Treaty would be automatically engaged, two against two, in the war for which Schlieffen had to plan. Europe was a heap of swords piled as delicately as jackstraws. One could not be pulled out without moving the others. Under the terms of the Austro-German alliance, Germany was obliged to support Austria in any conflict with Russia. Under the terms of the alliance between France and Russia, both parties were obliged to move against Germany if either became involved in a defensive war with Germany. These arrangements made it inevitable that in any war in which she engaged, Germany would have to fight on two fronts against both Russia and France. What part England would play was uncertain. She might remain neutral. She might, if given cause, come in against Germany. That Belgium could be the cause was no secret. In the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, when Germany was still a climbing power, Bismarck had been happy enough upon a hint from England to reaffirm the inviolability of Belgium. Gladstone had secured a treaty from both belligerents, providing that if either violated Belgian neutrality, England would cooperate with the other to the extent of defending Belgium, though without engaging in the general operations of the war. Although there was something a little impractical about the tail of this Gladstonian formula, the Germans had no reason to suppose its underlying motive any less operative in 1914 than in 1870. Nevertheless, Schlieffen decided, in the event of war, to attack France by way of Belgium. His reason was military necessity. In a two-front war, he wrote, "The whole of Germany must throw itself upon one enemy, the strongest, most powerful, most dangerous enemy, and that can only be France." Schlieffen's completed plan for 1906, the year he retired, allocated 6 weeks and 7/8 of Germany's forces to smash France, while 1/8 was to hold her eastern frontier against Russia until the bulk of her army could be brought back to face the second enemy. He chose France first because Russia could frustrate a quick victory by simply withdrawing within her infinite room, leaving Germany to be sucked into an endless campaign as Napoleon had been. France was both closer at hand and quicker to mobilize. The German and French armies each required 2 weeks to complete mobilization before a major attack could begin on the 15th day. Russia, according to German arithmetic, because of her vast distances, huge numbers and meager railroads, would take 6 weeks before she could launch a major offensive, by which time France would be beaten. The risk of leaving East Prussia, half of Junkerdom and the Hohenzollerns, to be held by only 9 divisions was hard to accept. But Frederick the Great had said, "It is better to lose a province than split the forces with which one seeks victory." And nothing so comforts the military mind as the maxim of a great but dead general. Only by throwing the utmost numbers against the west could France be finished off quickly. Only by a strategy of envelopment, using Belgium as a pathway, could the German armies, in Schlieffen's opinion, attack France successfully. His reasoning, from the purely military point of view, appeared faultless. The German army of 1.5 million that was to be used against France was now 6 times the size it had been in 1870 and needed room to manoeuvre. French fortresses, constructed along the frontiers of Alsace and Lorraine after 1870, precluded the Germans from making a frontal attack across the common border. A protracted siege would provide no opportunity, as long as French lines to the rear remained open, of netting the enemy quickly in a battle of annihilation. Only by envelopment could the French be taken from behind and destroyed. But at either end of the French lines lay neutral territory, Switzerland and Belgium. There was not enough room for the huge German army to get round the French armies and still stay inside France. The Germans had done it in 1870 when both armies were small, but now it was a matter of moving an army of millions to outflank an army of millions. Space, roads and railroads were essential. The flat plains of Flanders had them. In Belgium, there was both room for the outflanking manoeuvre, which was Schlieffen's formula for success, as well as a way to avoid the frontal attack, which was his formula for disaster.